You're listening to the Book Talk Today podcast, a podcast that inspires readers to obtain valuable insights to inform, educate, and improve lives. My name is Orhan Abdi. I'm an avid reader, best known for the creation of the 1 Minute Book Review community, and I'm sitting down with authors to delve deeper into the books they have written to uncover the story behind the story. Hello, Book Talk Today family, and welcome back to another episode of the Book Talk Today podcast. My name is Orhan, I am your host, and today we are joined by Jack Murray on the podcast to talk about his book, The Magic Slice, How to Master the Art of Storytelling in Business. It was a great conversation. Jack has over 25 years of experience with his company, Murray HQ, to talk about the power of storytelling. He's developed a platform where he helps PR and communications professionals get their story out there. And in this conversation, we talk about some of the elements that make great storytelling, from the practicality aspect, but also how leaders and people within organizations can develop a culture of great storytelling, but also how individuals, whether you're working in the company or whether you own a startup, about how to tell better stories and get your story out there. If you haven't already, please do subscribe to the channel. Every week I release a podcast with an author to talk about their book as well as the topics and principles inside of it. So please do hit that subscribe button for more. Without further ado, here is the podcast that I filmed with Jack. I hope you enjoy it. Jack, it's a pleasure to have you on.
Great. It's great to be on the show.
I love the idea of storytelling and I was fascinated with your book. I love the idea of what the power of storytelling has. You know, in literature, everyone knows the power of storytelling, but I almost feel in business and in nonfiction, storytelling is somewhat underutilized to a degree. So very excited to have you on to discuss the book, The Magic Slice. I think a great place to start is, what is the story behind the book itself, and what is the concept of The Magic Slice?
Well, the story starts with a story, and I'm Irish, as you know, and I grew up in a small town in the west of Ireland, a place called Ballinasloe, in a county called Galway. And I grew up in a family business, and the family business is in existence nearly 150 years. And I have a brother and a sister, and as we were growing up as children, my late dad used to tell a story about his grandfather, my great grandfather. And I think in every family there's a significant person in the history, and sometimes in the present in the family, who does something that kind of catapults a family to a different place. And that was my great grandfather. And the story we were told as children were that at some stage in the late 1880s, Ireland was a very poor country. Then, and the landlord ruling classes from Britain would have had peasant farmers. And my great-grandfather was one of nine children. He was the eldest on a small rural plot of land. And he got to 29 years of age and they ran out of money and they weren't able to pay the rent to the landlord. And somebody had to do something to save the family. And it came to a decision, and he said that he would leave and that he would go to America to try and raise some money to save the family. And if you could imagine it, he got on a ship and he arrived in to Hell's Kitchen in New York on Palm Sunday, 1886. And if you could, anyone who's seen Gangs in New York will know what, you know, you will have a sense of what that was like. You know, if you... Yeah. If you miss the knives and the violence, you might get typhoid or cholera or something like that. Like it was New York has always been a melting pot, but like it was all of what it is today, but far more dangerous. And you know, history does not record what he did while he was in America, save for one thing, that he got an idea to start a business. And the business that he got the idea to start was a general store. And I have this vision of him walking into an American general store thinking this would go really well back in Ireland. And he arrived back in Ireland sometime, and even the notion that he came back, like that he left so late and that he came back. And he came back, he must have come back with a bag of money because he bought, we grew up in a small town, but he bought half the town when he came back. And he became this really big businessman where he had a mill and he had a general store and it became a trading post. And the business he started in the 1880s, 1890s is still in existence today. And it was run by him, it was run by his son, it was run by my dad, who passed away 5 years ago, and it's now run by my mother and my brother. And I suppose I grew up in a tradition where all I knew was the generations of my family had worked in this business. And that was the story that, you know, that kind of sparked my interest in storytelling. Mm-hmm. I would have majored in marketing in university, and pretty quickly then went to work in politics as what you would call a spin doctor. So I got into the story business really quickly when I came out of university. I was 25. And, you know, the currency of how you would succeed in the spin doctor world was those with the best stories would succeed. Mm. So if you're a journalist, you're only as good as the last story that you've written. And if you're working for a politician, you're only as good as the story you're hawking or you're trying to get someone to have interest in that day. And, you know, I went from there into corporate communications. And I am getting to your point as to where does the magic slice come from. The magic slice came from then. I'm CEO of a company that I founded called Media HQ. And Media HQ is a software platform that helps communications and PR people find journalists and distribute stories. So we have a database of media contacts, and we help people distribute pitches to journalists and press releases. And if you go back about 7 or 8 years ago, we were about to hit this really big milestone in the company where the 100,000th story was about to be shared on the platform. And it was a big momentous occasion when you magic up a piece of software out of your head. Yeah. And part of the joy of doing that, and anybody who works in technology will know this, is when you see people, you create something and you see people using it. And I have a screen on my laptop that shows me the news just before the journalists read it. So it's this stream of people sharing positive news, negative news, announcements. And on that day, something kind of clicked in my brain about the brands and the organizations who knew how to communicate in a way that resonated with their audience. Mm. And this notion of the two circles, where one of them is what you want to talk about and one of them is what people are interested in, and where they intersect is your magic slice. And on that day, that fused in my brain, and it knocked around in my head. That was about 7 years ago. It knocked around in my head for about a year. And then I went on a kind of an educational trip to New York, to Brooklyn. And over a week, I wrote a pamphlet that had this concept in it. And the pamphlet is this beautifully, nicely printed 30-page document. And people requested, even this week, like from Sri Lanka to Sao Paulo, people requested. And we don't email it to people, we post it to them, because we feel like the idea is worth a physical object. And it was the genesis of the Magic Slice book. And it was that I suppose it took me a while to get around. Like I over the last 5 or 6 years, I kept saying to myself, I will write the book. And I made a couple of attempts to write the book. And some people found lockdown difficult. Whatever way my brain is engineered, I loved the kind of solitude of the lockdown. And at the start of the lockdown in March of 2020, I went into my home study and I opened a document and I wrote Last Attempt, Magic Slice Book. And that's where the book grew out of.
I love the idea of a generational business standing over the test of time. Do you believe that origination story, or the story of your, I think it was your great-grandfather, is it?
Yes.
Do you think that story is what has kept the business going this long?
I think it's part of it. I also think, you know, my dad died 5 years ago, and it's always an honor to be asked to deliver a eulogy. And my brother and I delivered the eulogy at his funeral. And when you're trying to sum somebody's life up, you know, a dedication to serving people, and you don't last in a small business for 150 years if you're in love with money, and you're in love with the work, and you're in love with the nature of what you do, you're in love with your place in the community. And even that whole that whole discourse of the currency of a story and sharing a story. And I talk about in the book, you know, our house every evening, there's a, you know, you would all gather when the shop would close for a meal, and my dad would come in, and like generally the opening line would be, "You'll never guess what I heard down the yard today." And he would trade in the currency of the stories that he had heard from the community during the day, and always had the ability to embellish and add stuff. So I think a generational business, you have to be dedicated, you have to love the work. There's a higher calling to it than money. You know, there's almost a socialism to it, I think, because I think if you were doing it for the love of the money, or it was just profit driven, it would have ceased a long time ago. And you know, there's a load of grain lofts in our business, because, you know, part over decades, part of it was a lot of the barley that would be harvested for Guinness was stored in the grain lofts and then brought to the Guinness brewery in Dublin. But, you know, nothing is really ever thrown out. And like the generational stories in a business like that, if you go up, and I do it, you know, I might do it every few years, you go up into one of the grain lofts and like there are ration books from the Second World War down there. There are ledgers from the 1920s. You know, there's merchandise from the shop from, you know, 1930. And it's there and it's untouched. And like, it's funny when something's like that, because, you know, I'd be the other way. Like, I'm software, I'm new, I'm change, I'm driven for change. And there is that bit where you just throw things away, and sometimes when you don't throw things away, they do come back in fashion. So I think all of that is what drives and it works, and it leaves an impression, and there's a kind of a, you know, there's a drumbeat to it that's kind of solid and consistent, that's nice as well.
What do you think are some of the elements then of the differences between storytelling for like a small business like yours, or one that is a bit bigger and has a larger impact on society in general? What are the different dynamics of storytelling between the two?
To be honest with you, I don't think there is a huge difference. I think in the book I talk a lot about this notion of a culture of storytelling, and how do you develop a culture of storytelling. And I think that's the first point, that you can have a small business that has a culture of storytelling, and you can have a large corporation that has no culture of storytelling, or you can have a large corporation that has a huge culture of storytelling. And like, we talk about a brand in the book like Patagonia, which has become a global brand, ethically focused, who sells an ethical message through what it does. But you can see it in a big brand like that, driven by a really kind of powerful mission, a charismatic founder. And I think in larger organizations, it has to be driven from the top, and it has to be driven from a charismatic founder. One of the businesses that I would have worked with in my time in corporate communications in Ireland was this company that manufactured timber frame homes. And back when it started in the early 90s, all of the construction here was concrete block construction. People didn't believe in timber. It had like 2% of a very large market. So it was kind of an act of madness to get into it. And long before climate change was ever an issue, you know, it was about a better, warmer house and more energy efficient. And people so didn't believe that story at the start that the only thing they'd buy off this company were the wooden roof trusses, because every house needed a wooden roof truss. And when I got involved in the story, we were selling that environmental message long before it became fashionable. And the end point of the story is the company was sold for $100 million to a big Irish conglomerate. And the story was such a huge part of selling it. Mm-hmm. And it was driven from the top by the CEO. So I think there aren't massive differences. And I think the organizations that are story, the larger organizations that are story driven, they do need a totem pole. They need somebody with flair at the top who's going to drive it on.
Do you believe that culture then has to be driven by that one individual? Can you not, do you not see it as being more of a culture adopted by more employees during their time there? Or do you think there has to have that one individual?
I think there has to be an understanding that it has to be driven by the individual. And like in my day job in Media HQ, we work with a lot of communications people and press offices. So we would work with hundreds of comms directors who would use our software to share stories. And, you know, there's a kind of a dichotomy. You can see the organization that's very communications driven, that every week is out there, and whether it's on social media, whether it's Instagram or Twitter or LinkedIn or the traditional media, they're communicating all of the time and they know who their audience is and they're getting messages out there. My schooling and storytelling came in a political party press office, and it's almost like an industrial factory for storytelling. So you come in the morning and like by lunchtime, you may have shared 10 stories by lunchtime, and they're generally less than 170 words, and they've got a big headline and they're a politician talking about something. And like I talk in the book about knowing your audience. People are very cynical and negative about politicians, but when you look at, it's as pure as the driven snow. If you look at a politician, they try to communicate with anybody in their constituency from 18 to the grave who's registered to vote. And if other people hear it, great, but that's who they really want to hear the message. And there is a thing about when you're communicating at an industrial level like that and sharing stories, you learn so much about the craft of communicating. And when younger people come to me now and they say, like, I'm trying to learn about storytelling, you know, what would you recommend? I'd say, get yourself a job in politics for a couple of years, because, you know, and that the thing is really interesting there, in that, like, everything that happens in the political environment, business can learn from. Always communicating very close to the media, always sending out messages, develop huge instincts for what works and what doesn't. And like the precursor to me writing this book on storytelling was like, I spent a decade running communications courses, running storyteller courses, prepping people in how to tell stories. And the biggest problem that people have in businesses are they don't communicate enough. So somebody would come and they would say, look, you know, I have a problem around getting my message out or my story out, and I can't. And when you break it down and you'd say to somebody, when's the last time you communicated with someone? When's the last time you wrote a story and sent it to a journalist or pitched them a particular idea for a story? And these people would do it 3 times a year. And that it would be a little bit like, it'd be like saying that you were going to get fit and that you were going to go to the gym every 3 months. Like you might get a cardiac arrest on the third visit, like, because you had literally no instinct for it. Yeah. And that, like, the really good communicators, and I suppose organizations, large organizations that are really good at storytelling, have an empowered senior director presence, who would be a director of communications, possibly with a team with them, but they have elevated the communications function to a senior level in the organization. So it's a clear stakeholder with everybody there, and people, they know it's part of the process.
I love the idea or the relationship to politics. I studied politics at university, and I love when I read history propaganda. I know propaganda gets a negative twist, but I think if you look at history, you can't deny the fact that propaganda has driven most of the large historical events that have happened. So do you think, like, if people were to study history and study propaganda, they might get a better tone for what great storytelling has to offer?
I agree. And I think, like, everything is propaganda. Like, it's really funny when you work in politics, like, you know, my wife is a political journalist, so we're surrounded by politics in our house. But I have a kind of a phrase that I use all the time around storytelling or around messaging, and it's versions of the truth. And, like, I remember, like, we're now what I call the post-social age. I remember going to a Future of Media conference in Amsterdam about 10 years ago, and it was talking about, you know, the ability of the internet to warp our memories, where we, you know, we'd be able to, if we had a bottle of beer in our hands at a pitcher, it could change the bottle of beer to a can of Coke, and the memory, it would alter our memory. And I remember thinking, have I taken mushrooms or something? Is this actually going to happen? And like, it is happening now. And like, you know, when you look at TikTok or you look at Instagram, and like, one person's truth is another person's propaganda. And propaganda as a word was created to besmirch somebody who very successfully managed to get their message out and connected with an audience. Mm. And like, what is alt-right but propaganda? Like, what is, like, you know, what is all of that kind of, you know, Trump movement but propaganda? And then people could also say that any ideology,
yes,
it's propaganda. It's truth wrapped up in something. And it's really funny, like, a lot of the concepts around politics are, you know, when you're telling a story, how do you make it more digestible? Like, I'm a big fan of sound bites, and I'm a big student of sound bites. So like, Bill Clinton was brilliant at it. Like, I come from a town called Hope. It's the economy, stupid. George Bush, the previous president who we bet, like, his soundbite was, they'll push and I'll say no way. I'll say, read my lips, no new taxes. And then he introduced new taxes, and that was, you know, that was the thing that undid him. And the beauty of all of those things are that, like, propaganda and soundbites are, they're sound branding for concepts. So anything that's a really difficult concept that you can sum up in a few short words or phrases. And I'm no big fan of Dominic Cummings, but like, this was his absolute art as somebody who had a narrative or a story that he wanted to tell in politics and who could reduce it. You know, let's get Brexit done won the last election. Like, it won the last election on a landslide, and people who weren't Tory voters voted Tory because they bought that story. And when it's done, and the other really, really interesting thing about political storytelling is that there's a great thing in politics where you can really admire how somebody operates without believing a word that they say. Mm. And when I worked in politics, like, you'd see someone who was a brilliant practitioner in the dark arts of storytelling, and you'd see what they were doing, and you'd just stand back in awe and think, that is unbelievable. And actually, it's funny, like, even as regards the, I suppose, the writers that I would find kind of inspiring, that would have kind of got me, that would have, you know, I would have admired, like, there'd be polemicists in one regard. Like, there's a brilliant book by a guy called Eric Hoffer that was written in 1951 called The True Believer. And it's about extremism, and it was written kind of after the Second World War. And it's almost like a passage from the Bible, you know, it's kind of like it's timeless. Small is Beautiful, written in the year I was born, 1973, by E.F. Schumacher, which, you know, there's a Schumacher College in Totnes around sustainability and all of that. Another timeless classic. These are the books I have by my bed, and they're kind of, they're almost like fables, but like, great stories are timeless. They're not about social media or about TV or radio. They exist in and of themselves, and they are, you know, they carry a punch, and they do the right thing.
What are some of the elements then that make storytelling? If we can go into the granulars, I think it'd be great just to touch upon your opinion about what makes a great story, or what are some of the elements that make stories timeless?
Yeah, so I suppose just a couple of things before, I suppose, to get into that. And I know you've done a lot of talk on the podcast around the science of storytelling. And one of the things to say about the book is, the book is a practical action guide for people who want to implement stories at work. And one of the reasons I wrote the book, there are lots of books on storytelling. There are very few books on like a practical toolkit to actually bootstrap it in and figure out, okay, that's grand, I understand it all now. How does the rubber hit the road? So the book has that energy in it. And at the start, before we get into the kind of elements of it, there's a bit about the science, and you would have talked a lot about that. And there's a bit about creativity. And if I can, just for a minute before I get into the elements and stuff about that, the key thing on the science about me is, from me is the only thing you need to know as a communicator on the science of storytelling is stories are a way to trigger hormones. And you need to know that hormone, if you know the transaction that's happening, you can tell a type of a story that triggers the hormone that you want to trigger to get the response. And we all do it every day inadvertently, but if you do it on purpose, and you know, there are tomes have been written on this, and I do a keynote where I do this, and I do an experiment on people, and I tell different types of stories to trigger different hormones, and there's always tears. When I deliver this keynote, people always cry in the audience. And I know that's going to happen before I tell the stories that I tell. Yes. And I kind of say to people afterwards, now, how do you feel after that? Like, and I think part of that transaction is that the knowing that the storyteller who's in full control of the full set of tools knows the type of stories to trigger dopamine, to trigger endorphins, and that they can engineer those in to get the reaction that they want. And I think that's really important. And I think once the penny drops on that, people think, oh, why wouldn't I do that? Why wouldn't I do that as a way of connecting with people? I suppose, and to your question then, around the structure of the story. So there's three aspects to stories, and people jumble them up all over the place. And the place where it normally starts is people say something like, you know, we need to make a video, we need to get an Instagram post out. So the first thing they do is they pick the straitjacket, and they say, we need something that looks like this, and they miss the whole point up to then. And what I say in the book is, let's just take three steps back from that. And every story has a number of different elements. And every good story has a number of different elements. And it has the protagonist, who is this story about? It has the antagonist, who's the negative force of evil? It has the inciting incident. And if you like Netflix or Amazon Prime, everything you watch, you'll see who the protagonist is at the start. Something will happen to them, which is the inciting incident. And then there's the journey. They will go on this journey of discovery in which they will face their worst fears, and they will learn about themselves externally, and they will grow internally as they do it. You have the turning point. And like, the bad news is this will wreck a lot of Netflix watching. And the turning point generally happens in anything good you watch on TV. It happens almost like slap bang in the middle. So if it's an hour episode, it'll happen after a half an hour. And the turning point is when the hero on the journey comes to a point where, you know, left is doom and right is salvation. And then there's the resolution. And there's the kind of, you know, what's the message that we learn from that, and how has the character grown? And those elements, the more of those elements you have in your story, the better the story it's going to be. And there's a couple of caveats within that then. The character needs to be likable. So, you know, you can take classic examples likable or compelling. Tony Soprano was compelling, and you know, people didn't want to admit he was likable, but he was likable. There's a phrase in Ireland, a likable rogue, and he was definitely a likable rogue. Yes. And
that's sorry to interrupt you, but that's why I feel like the murder mystery stuff is really interesting for people, because it's compelling. Like, and they almost get to the stage where they're intrigued by the individual, because anyone looking at, let's say, like a murder mystery, or for instance, like they do a bio on an individual who might have been a serial killer, whatever that might be, they might look at it thinking that person is evil for X reasons and they don't particularly care about it. But to me, it's compelling, because you're like, what would someone in that position think and what would they do? And like you said, it's either compelling or you feel sorry for them at the end.
Yeah, and I think the other thing about murder mysteries are, and the reason that the crime, and I'm a massive crime fan, I watch Sky Crime, there's such a dearth when you go to the shop to look at true crime, there's such a dearth of quality true crime. My favorite two books are in that genre are The Suspicions of Mr. Witcher and I'll Be Gone in the Dark, which is also a documentary. But one of the other reasons, back to my earlier point, one of the other reasons that you know, we all crave, I don't know about you, but like we crave dopamine, like we crave dopamine, like, you know, and when you explain to people that dopamine is that effect that you get in the coin fall in the arcade, and when you're sitting and you think, oh, I'll just watch one more episode, I just want what's happening is the brain is saying, I want more dopamine. And crime is the genre that just like you can mainline dopamine when you're watching crime, because the subtext in a story behind dopamine is the whodunit. So it's, you know, what's going to happen next? Oh, she did it. Oh, that's what's happening. And it's this whodunit thing that is at the absolute core of that. And so I suppose the first lesson for me to people in storytelling is it doesn't matter what the story is, if it's your foundation story. And I give a keynote where I unpack the lessons of storytelling through the story of my great-grandfather. Mm. And some of it has hardline facts and some of it is just completely imagined. And like we put him into Hell's Kitchen and we think, OK, well, he came back with a bag of money and, you know, he gets involved with the gangs in New York. He gets in all sorts of trouble. You know, he's like, what do we know in the classic story? And I told this to you at the start of the episode. He was 29 years of age. He is our hero. He goes to save the family. You know, that is his desire. His family are going to get thrown out of the farm. He needs to raise the money. He also left a girl behind when he left, and we know that because he married her when he came back. But they're all the classic elements of a story. And the beauty of the rules of storytelling are there is an infinite amount of stories you can tell, but all of the science will show that our brains are hardwired to take stories in the way that they should, in the elements that they should have, and in the way that they should be constituted. And that's a massive part of it. One of the other things that was really formative in my education on storytelling happened in the last 4 years. And there was a radio program on national radio here that I used to contribute to a lot. And they used to call me a lot to say, can you come on today? And, you know, is there anything? And then it got to the point where they liked me coming on so much, they'd ring and say, is there anything you'd like to talk about today? So I started working on this story idea, and it was called Media Moments. And it was about, I've become fascinated through my work on things that happen that change everything that happens afterwards. So the moment that Ellen took the selfie at the Oscars, the moment that JFK was assassinated, the moment the world realized that 1984 was an unbelievable work of fiction and a work of art. Yes. So
the
I pitched
toppling
this
of
idea.
Saddam. Like I remember that one as a kid so clearly.
The toppling
like
of Saddam, exactly.
The ropes, and they're out there slapping him with their sandals and stuff.
Yeah, Raggy Omar and the statue coming down behind him. And so I pitched them this idea, and the reason I'm telling you this because it's getting on to the next part of how to structure a story. And they came back to me and said, look, we love this. How many of these ideas do you have? And I said, I have 40. And anyone who's listening, if you go to Spotify or go to iTunes, just put in Media Moments and you'll be able to listen to them. But they're 10-minute episodes, and they're the story. So we have the elements. The next part of it is the structure of a story. And stories are told in three acts. The beginning, the middle, the end, the first act, the second act, and the third act. And the trick, which is almost like, you know, it's almost like a game. You've to get all the elements that we discussed into the story, and you've to get them in a set amount of time, and you've to paste them over the three acts. And I talk about this a lot in the book. And I'll give you an example from one of them. One of them, and we talk about this in the book, was the I've been fascinated with the story of 1984, you know, since I first read it in secondary school. And it's such a seminal book and such a seminal work of fiction. So I wanted to write about that. So as a storyteller, Steven Spielberg has this great line to talk about movie directors, and he says, great movie directors know where to point the camera. So you can kind of think, okay, imagine the story was just unfolding, and my job as the storyteller is to give a perspective on that story. So if you think of that story, the first question you ask is, okay, we want to tell a story about a media moment around 1984. What is the moment? Like, what is the great reveal there? And who is the hero? So I decided that the hero was George Orwell. And then, okay, well, what is the moment? And you kind of think, okay, what is the moment? And then just through detective work, I kind of said to myself, well, maybe the publisher was the first person to read it before the world read it. And maybe the moment is when the manuscript arrived at his desk. Okay, so that was a premise that I brought to that story. So as a storyteller, you're making decisions. You're deciding, okay, Orwell is the hero and this is the moment. And then you put your hat on, and I searched the Kindle, and I realized pretty quickly that Warburg, the publisher, had a biography, and it was on Kindle. So 5 minutes later, I'm reading that, and I find the chapter where he talks about the day that the book arrived. I go on Google Maps. I find the first edition copy of the book to find the address in London of the office. It was on the inside of the sleeve. I find the street on Google Maps. I walk up and down the street virtually. So I thought, okay, I can be the post person. I can deliver the manuscript. We know George Orwell is in Scotland, in the island of Jura, writing the book.
Yeah.
And the opening of the story is the morning. The first act is the morning that the post person comes to deliver this manuscript. And the publisher rips the top off the envelope, starts reading through it. And we get the quotes from his biography saying, look, you know, if we can't sell a million copies of this, we should be shot. And we're kind of, he said, this is the most terrifying thing I've ever read. And the elements are all there. The structure is there. And sometimes what people don't have is they start with this thing of, oh, we have to do an Instagram post, or we have to do this, or we have to do a video. And the third thing then you do is, you know, you get the story down on paper, and then you decide how to tell it. And like, there's a thing when they make movies where they say, if you're rewriting the script when the cameras are rolling, you're burning through money. And it's the same with anything. If you get the camera crew and they arrive and say, well, what's this video about? You go, oh, we didn't really think about that. We just thought we needed a video. And that you would be much better off spending the brain power on the storyboard aspect of it, and the shape and the elements. And look, in the book, we talk about all of the different outputs, the types of stories that you can tell.
Yeah.
But you don't get to that until you've decided all the other stuff.
Do you feel like people are too fixated then on the actual output at the moment, or the mediums for the storytelling aspect, whether it be YouTube or Instagram, Twitter? They're too focused on the actual of growing their following rather than just telling better stories.
Yeah, and like, it's really funny. Like, if you think of like the cave paintings in Lascaux in France, are like, what are they, thousands of years old? Like, yeah, they're a few thousand years old, more than that. So like, you know, it's a craft. You know, it's like speaking English. It's like wood turning. Like, it's like, you know, it's the art and craft of storytelling is a craft. Forget about Instagram and Twitter and stuff like that. Focus on the thing that isn't going to change, and focus on the high art. And like, it's really funny. Like, if you look at, we're in the golden age of storytelling. The Sopranos was the first 100-hour story. And if you're in TV production of drama now, the budgets, like, there's never been more money around.
Yeah.
And they've figured out a way to, like, we're all dopamine addicts, so they've figured out a way to mainline that through streaming online. And there's massive lessons there for brands, and the brands that are doing it. One of the examples in the book is Marriott Hotels. And they started, like, it's a really great example. They started in 2006 when they hired a head of communications. And her first thing was to get Bill Marriott, the son of the founder, at 76 years of age to start blogging. And the man couldn't even use a computer. And she said, look, you've got such a unique thought process on the hotel industry. Well, he said, I'll do it once a week if I can dictate it to you and you can put it on the internet. So she said, fine. And they went from that to setting up a studio, to winning an Emmy for a short movie that they did shot in a hotel. So they went on that complete storytelling journey. And people would say, oh, it's easy for them. Like what people often say in storytelling is, oh, it's easy for them. They had a huge budget. They started with a 76-year-old man dictating a blog post once a week. And then they grew out all of that. But people are too fixated on, like, what they want to do is they want to race to the thing, the shiniest thing with the sharpest edge, the Twitter post, the LinkedIn post, the YouTube output, without doing any of the legwork that'll get you there in a really sharp, successful way.
Yeah, I think that's what a lot of people, especially in my position, think about. They think too much about analytics. They think too much about which platforms to grow on, where they can get most of their engagement and reach. And something that has been a big brain changer for me, especially as soon as I had Will on and I read the book, The Science of Storytelling, and I've sort of absorbed my mind around this, is what is the story I'm trying to tell with this podcast or with anything that I do? It's very much fixated on what is the story that I'm trying to get out and what is the end point? What is the watcher, the user, the individual who's consuming this? What is their goal of consuming this? Because if you're just creating things for the sake of creating things, I don't necessarily think that is the best way to approach it.
Yeah, and I think like the other thing on that is that like small actions reverberate, and like small stories told well reverberate and kind of have a huge chain reaction. So like I said at the start that, you know, part of the genesis of this book with this was a pamphlet. Do I have a copy of it here?
There's the pamphlet.
It rips the post-it notes off it, called The Storyteller's Manifesto. And this was the genesis behind the book. And and the funny story behind that was, on the same trip, there's a shop which is now unfortunately no longer there, but there was a shop in Brighton just called Brighton Books, and they used to sell a lot of antiquarian books. And I went in there on this trip and opened a cabinet, and this book kind of fell out, and it was a 1940s military etiquette journal from Sandhurst Military Academy, and full of really sexist advice on commissioned officers, and you know don't when you go to the dance, don't take all the attention of the ladies, even though you may be the most handsome man in the room. And I was completely fascinated by this, and I brought it back to my designer and I said, I love this. I said, could we create something that looks like this, that like is full of wisdom? And I was thinking about Eric Hoffer, and I was thinking about Schumacher. I said, it's full of wisdom that is modern but could have fallen out of the past. And this was created as a pamphlet that was like that, and like has generated loads of business, created huge conversations, has got me great speaking gigs at conferences. Another great example that I get so buzzed about this example, a small regional airline in Iceland a number of years ago called Air Iceland Connects, and they wanted to create in-flight entertainment, and they wanted to do something around storytelling, and they wanted to create in-flight entertainment, and they had no money. Like they had no money. So like they were competing with people who were commissioning TV for screens on the back of seats, and they're like, what do we do? And like literally their budget was in the low thousands. So someone came up with this unbelievable idea to create a journal that would go in the back of the seats, and that when people would come on the flight, that they would take out the journal and they would write with a pen, like, oh, I did this and I did that, and this was amazing and that was amazing. And the spirit of the object was to pass it on. Mm-hmm. And they would put it back in the seat. And like it did a couple of things. It became kind of social media gold for like the Instagrammers. So they would come in and take pictures of the things that people had, and they would share that currency around. And then it kind of created this kind of analog kind of TripAdvisor kind of Expedia type experience in the seats, and kind of just full of that texture of like love and care and that people put into it. And like it became this media story then, because people thought this was really interesting, and the FT wrote about it, and it just kind of took off in a chain reaction kind of around the internet. And like 5 years later, I'm telling you about it. And like the best ideas are cheap, easy. They're like, hey, Bill Marriott, can you write a blog post? Hey, can we do a pamphlet that looks like something from the past? Or can we do something that fits in a seat? They're not multi-million kind of productions. And like you can tell, and the advice I give to people in the book is like, there's a great line in startups in America, you know, start small, but for God's sake, start. And there's a bit here where like start telling stories, but for God's sake, start telling stories.
Yeah, in your own unique way, and then you'll find what works, what doesn't work. You can amend it. You can learn from others who do it really well. I love watching people who are able to communicate really well. I think politicians are great. I know Barack Obama, when I was growing up, when I studied politics, he was like the guy for us to watch when it came to actually communication, whose ability to voice himself in front of a large crowd and get his point across in such a beautiful and eloquent way. I mean, you almost sit there absorbed by him, thinking, how is that someone able to do that in such a way?
Yeah, and like Bill Clinton would be the same for me. I think Clinton was like, I still think Clinton was the best at it. And I talk a good bit in the book towards the end of the book. So the book is in three parts. So first part is where we talk about creativity, science, and we describe that, what we've just talked about, like in a lot more detail about what a story is and what a story isn't. The middle part is the process to get the magic slice. And the last part is this bit about, okay, that's all fine, I know all that now. How do I put it to work? And one of the bits I talk about in great detail in the book is this thing about public speaking and like, how can you tell stories in person? And I'm quite unusual in that I love a crowd and I love standing in front. I don't know how you feel about that, but I'm
the same. I love it. Any opportunity to talk about something that I love to talk about, I'm fair game.
And it's kind of funny in that, like, some of the stuff that I kind of get into is like, how, like, for people, and when we do the storyteller courses for people, you try and explain to them, okay, how do you get better at telling stories in public, and how do you bring that into an organization? And people are very au fait with that concept of, oh, you know, we have to go to a team meeting, and if whether it's on Zoom or whether it's in person, we have to go to a team meeting, and Jack stands up and bores a hole in everyone's head with 20 PowerPoint slides and absolutely plunders our attention. And thanks be to God, I could pretend my camera was a dicky and I could actually be on Instagram because I didn't hear anything that he said. And then you go back to your desk and it's your turn the day after. And all you do is you just pass it on. So you literally do the same, you commit the same crime. And like part of what we do in these storyteller courses is we one of the things we do that like absolutely blows my mind every time we do it is we say to everybody who comes, can you give us a photograph that you're willing to talk about, and we will call on you randomly at some stage in the day to tell us the story behind the photograph. So you're sitting in the course and your name comes up and you come to the top of the room to tell the story. And there's so many instances of this. We did it for an airline once, and they're kind of senior corporate people, and one of the people on the course was a kind of she was a clerical help to the senior team, lovely woman, and it was a picture of her grandparents, and they were from another country and they had come to Ireland as immigrants, and she said, this is my nanny and my granddad. She said, you know, these are the people who got our family to where it is today. And my granddad worked for 30 years in a coal mine every day, risking his life and his health. And at that point, she started crying. And everybody in the room was crying. Yeah. And we could see this black and white picture of her nanny and her granddad. And everybody was welling up. And she sat down. And the reason we do that is we say to people, that's your A game. We just saw your A game there. So you went from the person who stands and drills a hole in people's heads, John from accounts, people are going, John from accounts had everybody crying. And you're going, because he actually did that. Did you see that? Did you feel that? Yeah, well, that's his A game. So why is he drilling a hole in everyone's head when he stands up and goes through stuff? And you bring them through that process of how not to do that with people and how to empower them with stories and kind of bring them on a journey. Part of it is practice. Like the stories that you tell, and like I always say to people, experiment. I tell a story, I'll kill it now in the description of it. I tell a story about going to the cinema with my friend Paul, and there's a video it was a poem that was an ad for Tesco that's really emotional. It's about family. And I play it and people kind of well up. And then I tell the story about how me and my friend Paul were sitting in the cinema, both welling up, both men. And I says, oh, how are you over there? Out of the dark, I said to him, how are you getting on over there? Oh, I'm not great, he says. I said, oh, fucking Tesco. And it always gets a laugh. And there's kind of, it goes from people feeling really emotional and awkward. And there's like always a letting. And like, when you tell a story and it works, you tell it over and over and over again. And when you experiment with something that doesn't work, it gets shelved really quickly. And like the other bit of advice about how to bring storytelling is, like, one of the things we do, which is brilliant for organizations, is I first did it, it's about 8 years ago now, but there's a brilliant organization set up by an Irish American called Tim O'Reilly, and they're just called O'Reilly. They're the biggest tech publishers in Silicon Valley. And but they have these conferences, and they're by invite only. And I was lucky enough to get an invite to one a number of years ago, but they have this format called Ignite, and it's 20 slides, and each slide lasts 15 seconds and they change automatically. So when you stand up, it's all over in 5 minutes. So for good or for bad, so if you're having a brilliant slide, making a brilliant, pithy, funny point, it's gone. And if you're dying, it's gone. And we say to people, so when we have a staff away day, everybody has to do one, and it kind of entertains everybody. And the rule is, it has to be something that you're passionate about, not about work.
Yes.
So people talk about their hobbies, their childhood, their pets, the things they like reading, the music they love. And two things happen. You open someone up as a communicator and you begin to see a side of them that you never saw before. And people learn really quickly how to do it. And like the other thing on speaking with stories is, a lot of companies have a template. And I always said to them, look, put the template in the trash. It's put it in the bin, because you need to empower people to be themselves. So how can you represent your brand essence? Like, imagine if somebody knew, oh, that person is from Media HQ from the way they speak, as opposed to the fact that there was a logo in the bottom right hand corner. And I think there's a huge amount of work to be done. I think there's an awful lot of boredom that goes on in organizations from how people communicate with each other.
Yeah, I think so. And I think it's obviously the nature of the organization determines the way in which they communicate and tell stories. But I definitely think there's a way to communicate that based on which industry you sit in. Like, for instance, my first job was in the civil service, and obviously there's a limit to how much we can storytell. But then if you're in a startup, obviously there's a different way that you can communicate.
Yes, yeah. And like, one of the great examples on the culture of storytelling that is delved in huge detail in the book is about Amazon and how they run their management meetings with memos. I sit here today with you. We have a management meeting tomorrow, and we enacted this change over a year ago. So I said, look, as I was writing the book, I was writing this stuff, and I said to people, okay, PowerPoints are banned. Don't want to hear anyone. You have to write a 4-page memo on your area. And it's amazing in that people say, well, like, what if people want the slides and go, read the memo, come to the meeting and talk about the memo. You don't need to be reading bullet points. You need to have a conversation about something. And the other amazing thing that they do, and it's not as easy as it seems, but if you're building something new, write the press release on the launch of it.
Yes.
At the start. And it's brilliant because, like, it takes every box of storytelling. It tunes you into the audience straight away. And great storytellers and great communicators have the audience in their mind's eye. So there are no difficult questions. There are just different pathways to connecting your story with your audience. And brilliant communicators know who they're trying to get the message out to. So in the case of this interview, it's business people, it's marketeers, it could be HR directors, and it's, well, what do they need to hear to make a decision or to move the dial? And that's the power of a story, that, like, it's an emotional transaction and you're hoping that people will act on it. And knowing who those people are and knowing the levers that you ask them to pull, by doing that thing with the press release that Amazon do, you're tuning into that, like, at the very start.
Yeah, and I remember hearing about that story. I think it was mid last year, and I thought that was an excellent idea, because it makes you focus on what you're actually trying to say before you even released it. So if it's a terrible idea, at least it can be stopped by the time you've done the press release, and then you don't have to deal with all the negative fallout of pitching and shipping a bad idea.
No, it's true. And it's like, it's funny, like we've talked a little bit about storytelling in the kind of TV sense or in the Netflix sense on this. Yeah. And I have a friend who's quite an accomplished actor, and he lives in my neighborhood, and we bump in all the time. But our latest line of discussion when we bump in, when we're both walking our dog, is when you get a reading of a really bad script. So like, we're talking about a really bad story. Like when you do a table read of it, like, and you know, this is a big production, like, do you say it, like, and because we've all watched something this, and he said, there's a bit where you're given really helpful feedback, and then at a point you just say, oh look, I'm getting well paid for this, I'm just going to read it. But like, it never ceases to amaze me, like you watch something and you think, oh, this cost 100 million, and the story is just really poor. And actually, it's, if they'd paused, yeah, and got the story better. I just finished watching The White Lotus, and you know, I watch these things through a couple of different lenses. I watch it through the lens of being entertained, but I'm always looking at the story. And to watch something that's kind of fresh, original, really good characters, really good twists, like, it's one of the best things I've seen in 4 or 5 years. And it was like, it was down to lots of reasons, but the story was just cracker, and I hadn't seen anything like it. And it's really unusual for that to happen.
Yeah, and it hits you in a different way. My brother and I recently, we watched all 3 of The Lord of the Rings in the cinema again, because they were re-showing it. And every single time I watch it, I just think about that this is such a brilliant story. The story is amazing. The way in which they captivated that through cinema, J.R. Tolkien's books are great anyway, but the way that they transferred that into cinema was fantastic. And every single time I watch it, I'm always captivated by it, even if I watched it a month ago. It doesn't change. Great storytelling has the ability to make you feel a certain way that nothing else can't.
No, and I think like the import of that for anyone who's listening to this is like, how can I tune into those elements? And everybody, the good news is everybody can. And it doesn't have to be a Hollywood blockbuster. It could be just a challenge that you have at work. It could be a new product that you're bringing in. It could be something educational that you're trying to do. It could be, you know, it could be you're trying to raise funds. It could be that you're trying to hire better people. You could be launching something new. And there are stories around all of that. The best products and services solve problems for people. Yes. And they go through this journey where, you know, being an entrepreneur, being in business, it's really hard. So the traditional old way of kind of clean, fresh lines on communication. The good news now is that in the era of social media, people love process. They love the kind of from the jagged edge to the shiny thing. And the old way to communicate was, you know, we launched the shiny thing and it goes out into the world. People love that whole journey from the very initial idea right to the end now. And there's, you know, you can tell as many stories as you want as you go along that. But you have to be committed to it. And I suppose you have to have that energy to kind of continue to revisit it.
I think on that point, actually, I think a great place to end is in the book you referenced John Hegarty, I think, in reference to one of the main attributes to creativity, which is perhaps one of the bedrocks of great storytelling, is creativity, as he defined, which is fearlessness. So can you just talk about how to cultivate a habit of fearlessness and what that means for creativity and great storytelling?
Yeah, and like, the funny thing about fearlessness is that it's not any great act of bravery to cultivate fearlessness. It's actually, in and of itself, being willing and able to fail and encouraging failure. So in corporate environments, failure is a bad word. And one of the reasons that people don't engage in new initiatives and creativity, and if you look at the way a lot of big corporate environments are, there's such a desert of creativity that they bring in an agency or they bring in someone from outside. So the ecosystem is so arid that they can't even come up with an idea themselves if they have to hire in somebody smart from outside who's got a different ecosystem to do it, someone like a John Hegarty. And if, like, I have friends who are writers, I have friends who are musicians. No great art, great poetry, great sculpture would would be created if people were worried about what people thought. And one of the really bad things about the world right now is that everyone has an opinion, and whether it's on Twitter or it's on Instagram or it's on TikTok, the minute you stick your head above the parapet, someone will say, that's rubbish and I hate that, and, you know, oh, that's kind of... And like anything good that happened, someone stuck their head up and believed in the song, believed in the album, kept going and kept writing. And one of the things that I learned, and actually I learned it through that process of that radio series I did. So in 40 weeks, I wrote 40 10-minute stories. And it was a real passion project. It took forever. And like each one took 10 or 11 hours to write and record. But one of the things you learn is creatively is that if you believe in your heart in what you're doing, and you believe in what you do, you don't really care what people think. And if I look at this book, it's the book I wanted to write. I poured my heart into it, and I don't really mind what people say about it, because it's the book that I wanted to write. Now, that's the way I would advise people to approach the stories they tell and the work that they do. And fearlessness is about taking ownership for the work that you do, be fully invested in it, and when you get to the point that you have to push it out into the world, think, some people may not like this, but I don't care, because I know it's as good as it can be, and I know I've given it everything I can. And I think that's what needs to happen, because the culture that's in lots of places now is, what if everybody hates it, and what if people think it's terrible? People may think it's terrible, but like, if you know it's not terrible, and you know it ticks the boxes that you put into it, then you'll be fine with that. And there's nothing quite as powerful as someone saying to you, I didn't really like that. And you just go, kind of Larry David, like you're going, yeah, whatever. Yeah. And it's because you have your own truth about what you put into it. And that's what kind of fearlessness is. Like, I have a friend who's brought out 7 or 8 albums, and I have a friend who's just written a children's fiction, a novel for teenagers, a fantasy fiction book. And like, you pour yourself into it and you get the art out there, or you get the story out there. And it's the same, like, the communications people who are fearless, they just communicate, they get out there. The politicians, the business leaders, they get criticized every day. Yeah. I had a client at the start who used to say, persistence beats resistance. And, you know, fearlessness is about persistence beats resistance, and it's about embracing that energy. And the advice I'd give to people is, you know, get out there, tell your story, start connecting with the world. You learn and you iterate from the connections that you make with people. Put your heart and soul into it, believe in it, and when you do that, you know, you'll be able to stand over it no matter what happens. And that's the fearless transaction.
I think believing in it is like the bedrock to telling a good story, because you know when someone's telling a story and they don't believe it, and you can feel the fact that they don't believe the story they're telling, because they tell it in such a way that it's just not imbued with any type of passion. I mean, I've been there, I'm sure you've been there many times, where someone tells you a story and they might have great intentions for the story, but you know that then their heart and soul's not in it.
Yeah, and it's funny, like, I came from a place where I was briefing politicians actually, it's funny, this transaction is very real, in that the media interaction that I was most fearful about when I was prepping politicians was the extended interview, because in an extended interview, you cannot hide who you are, you know. Yes. In a 5-minute kind of, you know, news interview, that you can be briefed. And it's very easy to tell now, the person, we, like, human nature being what it is, we all have a brilliant antenna now for the person who's authentic, that great word, and the essence of authenticity is huge in storytelling. But we can tell about who's authentic and who believes in it, and who's faking it. And you know someone who believes, and, like, you know what they say is, like, you know, if you can fake authenticity, then you've made it. And like, the real sign of being really good is, it, like, if you can convince people you believe when you don't, then you're on a whole other plane, you know.
Yeah, you're on a whole different level to the rest of us. You should start selling that. If someone knows how to do that, you should start selling it. We're a books podcast, obviously, Jack, and I know you mentioned some of your personal favourite storytelling books earlier, two of them in particular. Do you mind sharing some of your personal favourite books on storytelling or books that have influenced you in your journey for storytelling?
Yeah, and like the books that would have influenced me, they're not necessarily about storytelling. I was lucky that two of the writers who most influenced me on my journey, who I was lucky enough to meet them. One is Seth Godin, and yes. The clarity with which he writes, his generosity of spirit, The Purple Cow would have been the book that would have put Seth Godin, his ability to communicate with people through stories and how he communicates. Seth yes. would be someone who, you know, even in the process of writing this book, I would have emailed him and had contact with him, and is a brilliant storyteller. The other one who's an amazing storyteller is Charles Handy. And Charles Handy grew up in Ireland and then moved to the UK, and two books that he wrote, The Age of Unreason and The Empty Raincoat, would have come out kind of late 80s when I was 15, 16. He came to speak at an event in Ireland about 10 years ago, and I got to meet him, got him to sign one of my early copies, and wrote about business and economics when I was studying in second level, and then I did a business degree. So they would have really made a difference to me. The other book that I read actually in the last year is by a contemporary writer, business writer called April Dunford, and she has written a book on positioning, and the accessibility around how she wrote her book, obviously awesome on positioning. I wanted this book to be a book that people who didn't read would read. And I wanted yes. it to be an easy read, and I wanted it to be a book where people would pick it up. We in Media HQ read her book, and I was on the final draft of The Magic Slice, and you know, I had a breakthrough moment when I read her book, which was equally good and bad, where I read her book and went, oh, this is so easy to read, and it's so for people. And we all read her book in 2 days, and I thought, okay, one more rewrite. And imbued with the spirit of making it easy to read and accessible, and make it for, because business people don't read books. Business people don't like reading books. And, you know, can you make it as easy a transaction as possible so that those, and part of the thing about The Magic Slice was I wanted people to read it, but I've spent, you know, over a decade helping people to get better. And my opening line to people on a communications course is, it's great to be out of the office for a day, but if you don't make any meaningful change to your life out of being here today, it's a waste of time and it's a waste of money. My motivation is to give you at least two or three things to catch you by the ears, to shake your head and say, look, how can you upgrade? How can you level up? How can you have different processes? And my job is to kick up enough dust to help you to do that. And yes. the process of writing The Magic Slice was to give people 6 steps to find that place where what they want to say intersects with what people want to hear. And to give them, like, I suppose, you know, it was a book that was written in 7 or 8 months that was 20 years in the making. It captures my voice very well. And I think it's that thing of, I'm hoping that the transaction with people is easy, and that it doesn't matter that if you're a marketing director or you're a CEO or a founder, that there's something in there for everybody about how to get better at telling stories and understand why pausing. And even if you just take your slide deck and you put 2 stories into it that resonate with people, and that becomes your currency, then that's success, because your impact will be greater on the audience.
Definitely. And as someone who reads a lot of books, not specifically on storytelling, just in general, I think one of the downsides of sometimes reading a book like this is they just give you a load of theory and they tell you what you should do, but they don't actually ask you questions of what the next steps are, which is particularly why I like this book, is because it's like, if you look at my notes here of the book, it's very much, okay, this is what I want to do for this project. This is what I want to do for this project. Making me rethink strategies for things that I've done, even for this podcast as well. So I think that's perhaps the magic behind The Magic Slice, is it's very much imbued with action, which I think is rare sometimes with these types of books.
Yeah, and that was the real point of it, in that, like, you know, there's lots of books, as we've said, about storytelling, but, you know, after every chapter, there's a points to ponder. So we take 30 seconds to say, look, I think these are the most important things you should be thinking about in this chapter. And then as the book goes on, as you get into the magic slice, there are exercises to do. And we do this thing, and I would do it a lot when I'd be training. You'd be kind of saying to people, okay, you're at this point now. At this point, you should know this, this, and this. And on top of this platform, we're going to build this other thing. And you can dip in and out of it, but you can also think, oh, well, maybe I need to revisit my foundation story, or, you know, we should probably have a look at the mission because everyone's confused about the mission.
Yeah.
And the beauty of this is that it's all interconnected. So, you know, great storytelling comes from a really driven organization that understands its mission. And it is this notion of, like, great communicators, back to that point, they know who the audience is and they know where they want to move the dial on it. And then there's all of these different elements. So look, it is like, it's like the Facebook status. It's complicated, but you know, if you're not tuning into the different elements, you're definitely not making them better. Yes. And the book lays out the different elements in the six stages to help people tune into that. And then, as I said, the last bit then is this thing of, you know, brand newsrooms, a culture of storytelling, what are the tools at my disposal? And we get to them at the end because they're the outputs of knowing all the other stuff. They're the tip of the iceberg.
Yeah, you have to have awareness of the key fundamentals before you move to any action. I think some people are too soon to move to the action instead of actually understanding and having awareness of the fundamentals, especially in this space.
No, exactly. And I think there's a bit where, like, when I meet younger communicators, or I would mentor a lot of younger people, and they'd say, you know, what advice would you give to somebody earlier in their career, and get to a place where you can practice your craft every day, so that, like, there's no block between you and practicing your craft. And it is the Malcolm Gladwell 10,000 hours. It's the Beatles playing in that basement in Hamburg, and just literally their fingers bleeding because they were playing the instrument so much. And that was me at 25 in a political press office, given half a policy and a number of candidates, and told, off you go now, get those people elected. And it was kind of like an act of madness. But it was also this thing where, you know, the next room was a room full of journalists. My wife was one of them, and I met her, like, and, like, it was kind of almost like pre-email, where you'd be going out. I make it sound prehistoric now, but you'd email the statement, but you'd also do that physical act where you'd walk around with printouts of the statement into the political journalists, and you'd hand them out just to say, in case you missed this. And then someone would ask you about another story, or they'd ask you about another policy. And it was just this notion of connecting with your craft every day, and communications is a contact sport. And the best way people can build their craft is to get out there and to do it. And it's only by doing it that, you know, you'll think, oh, well, that's not working, I need to stop that, or I need to completely double down on that. And and that's the joy of it.
That is definitely the joy of it, Jack. It's been a pleasure to discuss the book with you, The Magic Slice, and thank you so much for taking the time to come on. Where's the best place that individuals can reach out to you, learn more about the book, and also about yourself?
So I have a website called Murray Story. I spend a lot of time on LinkedIn, so feel free to hit me up with a LinkedIn request. And on Twitter, I'm Media Murray. So any one of those three platforms, people will be able to get me.
Perfect. And where is the book available? Is it available everywhere or just in specific places?
It's available everywhere. And, like, for an international audience, you'll get it on whatever your local Amazon is on. It'll be available there.
Perfect. Thank you, Jack.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for watching this podcast. I really hope you've taken away some tools and practices in order to become a better storyteller in whatever field you're in. Jack is charismatic and full of many great tips, so I definitely recommend checking out his book, The Magic Slice. I'll put a link in the description below to the Amazon link, and if you purchase it through there, then I get a bit of a kickback as well, so I appreciate that. Thank you so much for watching this podcast again, and if you haven't subscribed, please do subscribe to the channel for more content. Every week, we release a podcast with an author to talk about their book and talk about some of the tools and practices and principles within the book as well. Thank you again for watching this podcast, and I'll see you in the next one.